From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at the rising rate of suicide among Black Americans and Black children in particular. Capitol Notes digs into Wisconsin Republicans' lawsuit challenging a get-out-the-vote effort in the city of Milwaukee.
What's interesting about the suit is not just that the Republican Party wants a prohibition on Milwaukee officials participating in it. They want to ban this effort, period. I don't know if that's possible.
Then our Book of the Month series gets a recommendation to get you in the mood for scary season, but crucially will not frighten you too much.
I picked it for many reasons. Number one, I was assured that it wouldn't make me too scared. Pretty much a 99% romance reader at this point in my life.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'd like to caution listeners about our first conversation, which discusses suicide. If you or anyone you know is in crisis or thinking about self-harm, trained help is available. And you can talk to someone at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by dialing 988. Suicide among Black Americans is on the rise. Between 2014 and 2019, suicide increased by 30% in the community. It was also the second leading cause of death among Black Americans ages 15 to 24. For Black children, the suicide rate has been increasing faster than any other racial or ethnic group. Dr. Janelle Goodwill is an assistant professor at the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. Her research focuses on the mental health experiences of Black Americans throughout their lives. She spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about some of the trends researchers are noticing, like the significant increase in suicide among Black children.
That's different than what we've seen historically, where it's mostly been teens and young adults, but we are definitely seeing an increase in suicide among young Black children, which is hard to really wrestle with and conceptualize that someone as young as 8 years old would know the steps to take to end their life. And so that certainly has implications for families, but also for the types of services and interventions that are offered in schools. On top of that, something that has been sticking out and I have been noticing that other people have certainly addressed and are really trying to make sure that we are paying attention to is the fact that the gap between suicides among Black teen or adolescent males and Black adolescent females is narrowing in recent years. So what that means is that historically we've seen suicide rates be much higher among males, and that's actually pretty consistent across race groups. Across most race groups in the US, we do see that women are more likely to make an attempt, although males are more likely to actually die by suicide. Mm. That's largely due to the lethal methods that they use, which is oftentimes a firearm, whereas maybe a woman might be more likely to try something like pills, to try an overdose. There's a higher success rate in terms of being able to save that person versus when they use a firearm. So in recent years, we've seen this gap among Black adolescents by sex. We've seen this gap narrow. So essentially, the number of suicides, the rates among Black teen girls has increased in recent years, where typically that gap has been pretty wide between Black teen boys and girls.
What can you say is contributing to the negative mental health of Black people that might contribute to thoughts of suicide or death by suicide?
Yeah, so essentially the literature right now has taken some important steps towards this. It's been revealed that bullying, interpersonal problems, and also experiencing not having access to mental health treatment have all been things that have been found to appear really amongst young Black people who've died by suicide. So, for instance, when comparing the experiences of young Black children who died by suicide to children of other races, we've seen that Black children have been less likely to actually have received mental health treatment before their death. They've also experienced serious concerns around bullying and even interpersonal problems with family and friends. And so I think maybe my main point through a lot of this is that access, awareness, and treatment, I think are some of the most key and pressing issues that I think if we're able to do, we as researchers and clinicians are able to do a much better job in terms of providing access to culturally relevant treatment, then I think we could definitely do a much better job of ensuring that Black youth, Black children, and their families have the necessary tools to address these mental health crises when they arise.
So Black youth suicide has been labeled a crisis, but do you consider suicide among Black Americans in general to be a crisis?
I do, personally, and I say this because suicide is not a new occurrence. Suicide is getting a lot of traction and attention publicly now. I think a lot of news outlets are covering the topic more now, and we've unfortunately seen some high-profile suicides that have occurred in recent years. I'm thinking about just the experiences that we've seen publicly with Regina King's son and also Chesley Chris. And, you know, those are two Black young adults who had not even reached, you know, 31 years of age yet. I could point you to studies that were published 30 years ago that tried to really warn researchers and clinicians of these emerging trends. But because we have seen suicides increase in young people, we also have to think about, if young people are experiencing stressors, then imagine essentially what their parents are experiencing, because parents are also experiencing a lot of stress right now and are also now tasked with trying to figure out how to best support their kids. And I certainly imagine that many parents are feeling overwhelmed and not knowing where to go to receive help, to get their kids supported, but to also try to improve their own well-being. So I think it's a crisis that we're seeing really across the lifespan, but we do see differences by age group when looking at the experiences of suicide and suicide rates across different races. So essentially what the data are pointing us to is that Black people are dying by suicide at earlier ages when compared to other race groups.
What can people do to help our loved ones to show that we're here for you and we want to give you that support? What can that support look like? Or what should it?
I would encourage people to recognize that there's already been some really helpful resources that have been provided that can provide friends and family members with language, guidance, and tools that will allow them to be a better support to their loved ones who might be experiencing suicide risk or other serious mental health concerns at the moment. So I would encourage folks to go and visit AFSP.org. That's the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.org. There on that website, they actually provide people with scripts that they can use in regular conversation with their loved ones who they're concerned that might be experiencing suicide risk right now. Also, I think directly asking someone if they are thinking about suicide, if they've made a plan, are really important questions to ask. I think sometimes people assume that asking someone if they're suicidal is going to give them the idea or make them suicidal. Mm-hmm. And I want to confirm that research does not support that. Research does not support that asking someone if they're suicidal will make them suicidal. So I just want to encourage folks to know that asking someone is not going to harm them in that way. Instead, it could really open up a door for them to be vulnerable with you and telling you what they're going through. So directly asking, and then from there, seeking mental health support locally and even online, I think are some important next steps. But again, the AFSP.org, they have very specific scripts that people can use when talking with their loved one, whether it's a child, a family member, or a friend who might be experiencing suicide risk right now.
What are we still learning about suicide in Black Americans?
So we're still learning more about the reasons why. There's a recent study that found that Black youth and Black adults have been less likely to leave notes when they have ended their life by suicide. And so there are times when someone who leaves a note, they may express the reason why they're choosing to end their life. Other times in a suicide note, people may just provide directions or instructions around, you know, what their family members should do after their death. But without the note, I do think that perhaps family members and friends are really left with a lot more questions, certainly than answers. And then ultimately, the people that we really need to hear from are those, I think a lot of times, who are no longer here with us. And so we simply just don't know a lot around the qualitative reasons why someone is wrestling with or choosing to end their life. In short, there's been a lot of quantitative surveys, but there has not been a ton of qualitative research that asks people directly, either doing interviews or focus groups or any sort of approach that's qualitative. Essentially, those things would allow us to have a lot more insight, but researchers I think we have a lot more work to do in that area.
Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share?
Yeah, I want to, again, go back and share that and really double down on this and saying that asking someone if they're suicidal is not going to make them suicidal. That's a myth that we really want to try to dispel. So I want to encourage family members, friends, loved ones, that if there's someone in your life that you're concerned that they may be suicidal, to directly ask them. And then from there, stay with them and help them get connected to resources, whether that's a local clinician, whether that's the hospital. I think that it really is important for individuals who are experiencing suicidal thoughts, or even those who have planned an attempt, it's really important for them to know that they have people who are with them, who are not going to leave them, and who are going to be supportive and with them throughout this journey. I think it's also important for folks to recognize that this really can be a team approach. I mean, I want to encourage parents to not feel shame if they don't know where to go for help. If anything, that's more of a systemic issue that researchers or clinicians or even school administrators really are in a position to do a much better job of making sure that families and parents and caregivers know where and how to seek help for their children when they face the mental health concerns. So this is why utilizing those online resources, like I mentioned earlier, is going to be really helpful. And also, just doubling down on something that I mentioned earlier, I think it's important to build the culture of prevention. So essentially, it's beginning much earlier and ensuring that young people have the tools and know where to seek help before suicide risk occurs. I think sometimes we are responding to a current attempt or a current risk versus being proactive and ensuring that structurally we provide the tools early on before there's any suicide risk. I think that could definitely be helpful in making sure that we're doing a better job of supporting young people moving forward.
That was WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell speaking with Dr. Janelle Goodwill, an assistant professor at the University of Chicago. A reminder to our listeners, if you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts, trained help is available. You can talk to someone at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by dialing 988.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. He provides a roundup of what you need to know this midterm election year. Here's our latest conversation. Hi, J.R. It's great to have you on Capital Notes.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I guess the theme of the past week has been lawsuits, lawsuits, lawsuits. When it comes to lawsuits filed this past week, we've got everything from Wisconsin GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss challenging a congressional subpoena to a group trying to bar election clerks from throwing out ballots with witness information left off of it. Can you give us like the breakdown of these lawsuits?
Well, there are a couple different baskets of them, right? One is the Robin Voss lawsuit, which is unique because I've never seen a legislative leader in Wisconsin be subpoenaed by a House committee, or two, a lawsuit filed in district court in Wisconsin trying to quash that subpoena. So the House Select Committee, looking at the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol, wants to interview Voss about his July 2022 conversation with Donald Trump, in which a former president sought to pressure Voss to try to overturn the 2020 election. Voss has said repeatedly that can't happen, but Trump was pressuring him in light of a state Supreme Court decision that ruled going forward from that moment, drop boxes were illegal for absentee ballots, did not apply retroactively, but still Trump tried to cite that as a reason to overturn the election results. Then you had the House committee issuing the subpoena on a Saturday to try and get Voss testify on a Monday. He quickly went to federal court, and now we'll find out, one, does a federal judge in Milwaukee have standing to decide the controversy, and two, does Voss have a legitimate argument when he says that that conversation was outside the purview of the House committee's work on the 2021 attack on the Capitol. And two, he has legislative immunity that prevents him from asking him about that conversation. So we have that. Then we have conversation or lawsuits about absentee ballots. One, you mentioned kind of a Dem-leaning group filing a lawsuit saying, hey, we need to have an order to clarify that clerks, what they can accept on an absentee ballot envelope from witnesses, right, for their address. So recall, the Elections Commission in 2016 had laid down a definition of what an address is. That guidance was part of an overall package that also talked about curing absentee ballot envelopes for witnesses, saying that clerks could go back in, and if they had available information at their fingertips, they could fill in missing things like a zip code or a municipality for an absentee ballot witness. You know, they have to sign the ballot to witness that it was cast by the elector before it's sent in. That guidance had to be rescinded because a Waukesha County judge said you cannot cure ballots as clerks. Only the voter can do that. So Elections Commission says, hey, our definition of an address still exists, but guidance doesn't carry the weight of law. This lawsuit says there's potential for different standards to be applied in different communities. Therefore, they want a Dane County judge to issue an order saying that if you leave off your zip code, for example, as a witness, then that ballot will still be counted. Remember, there's nothing about the ballot itself. It's about the envelope the ballot comes in. Then we had another lawsuit filed seeking to say if you are somebody who cast your ballot absentee, you can't go to your clerk and say, hey, I want to change my mind. I cast my ballot for candidate X a couple weeks ago, and I want you to spoil that ballot so I can vote for candidate Y. They want an order saying that can't happen anymore. So you have that lawsuit. Then we have open records lawsuits. Then we have this lawsuit against the Milwaukee over Milwaukee Votes 2022. Now, I will tell you that when I became a Capitol reporter 22 and a half years ago, I never thought I'd spend so much time in court or reading briefs as I do now. But that said, it's a very litigious society we live in today, and that counts for politics too.
Let's talk about specifically the lawsuit that the state Republican Party filed challenging Milwaukee's involvement with Milwaukee Votes 2022. Can you give us the backstory just on that?
Sure. So this is a privately funded effort by groups seeking to get people to vote. Now, they have argued that the city is not funding it, but Cavalier Johnson, the mayor, made this kind of announcement in, you know, a couple of weeks ago saying, hey, you know, we support this effort and there's going to be a widget on our website to direct people to it, you know, so they can kind of help. And officials went, whoa, 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 what's going on? You know, you guys are, you know, public officials. Should you be doing it? Is there some kind of inappropriate about this? Especially because a firm involved with the groups, the firm is not, by the way, running the effort. It is just helping the groups who are doing the GOTV effort, is headed by a former Democratic operative. So that was a red flag for Republicans. Then they filed open records requests. Those documents came back and they found out that a Democratic operative, a different one, who's been a longtime advisor to Cavalier Johnson, was coordinating a message with his city staff on how to respond to these media requests. Another red flag for them. Now, I don't know if there's anything illegal going on. City officials say there is not, that they're not funding this, they're not receiving private funds, that, you know, they're not doing anything inappropriate. It's just an interesting look, some would argue a bad look, to have an operative, a political operative, coordinating or advising the mayor on what to say about official business. Now, this operative has been a long time, again, advisor to Johnson that, you know, is maybe entirely appropriate, but it's given Republicans fodder to file this lawsuit. And remember, Republicans are still upset about 2020. There was this group called the Center for Tech and Civic Life, I think it was, that was funded largely by Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook founder. He poured millions of dollars into this group to help give grants to communities across the country to help pay for the cost of putting an election during a pandemic. The rub for Republicans is, if you like, that money went disproportionately to Democratic-leaning cities and helped drive Dem turnout in the presidential election. They see hints of that in what's going on here. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to tell you if there is or is not, but we will soon find out in court, possibly, whether something inappropriate happened in this entire effort. And if nothing else, it's giving Republicans fodder to gin back up their base about an issue that base really cares about, the private money for election costs.
You know, but I know you said you're not necessarily going to address the legal issues, but they're claiming that this Milwaukee Votes violates state law. You know, they're sort of citing a law that says that public employees are prohibited from using public funds to achieve partisan objectives, but that's not what's happening here.
See, and that's their argument, is that they're basically getting at a partisan objective with what they're doing, because, again, it's largely would be focused on turning out Milwaukee, which is, you know, leans Democrat by good chunk, right? So that's the argument. Yes, I'm not going to weigh in. I can't weigh in on whether that's legal or not because I'm not a lawyer. I'm not as well versed enough in the statutes to say what the line is. A judge will decide that possibly through this lawsuit. What's interesting to me about this suit is not just that the Republican Party wants a prohibition on Milwaukee officials participating in it. They want to ban this effort, period. I don't know if that's possible for a judge to tell a collection of private groups, you can't do this. But they're trying to say that this should be shut down by a judge and not be allowed to go forward.
And is there a difference between an effort to drive up voter turnout overall in a Democratic-leaning area and an effort that sort of asks people to vote for Democrats or just targets left-leaning voters?
That's a great question because, you know, the people who are doing this effort saying, look, it's nonpartisan. We want everybody to vote. But if everybody in Milwaukee votes, it's good for Democrats. That's just a math game. Look at the city. It overwhelmingly favors Democrats. So when you're driving up turnout in a nonpartisan way in a very Democratic city, it's going to help Democrats. And that's part of the rub for Republicans, again, that fear of, okay, is something inappropriate going on here? And let's be honest, politically, it's better for Republicans to have low turnout in Milwaukee because there are more Democrats in Milwaukee than there are Republicans.
All right. Well, thanks for the rundown, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime.
That was J.R. Ross of WisPolitics.com speaking with me, WUWM's Maayan Silver. Listen for our segments every Monday with an extended segment on Lake Effect, and check out the Capitol Notes podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, we'll get a scary book recommendation from the Milwaukee Public Library. That pays homage to both Halloween Horror and Hispanic Heritage Month. But first, Bubbler Talk explores the impact murderer Jeffrey Dahmer had on Milwaukee's gay community in the 80s and 90s. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers, and it's Monday, which means it's time for Bubbler Talk, our series where we answer listener questions about the region. This week, in light of the Netflix series Dahmer, we're revisiting one of my previous pieces, which explores how Jeffrey Dahmer's crimes affected Milwaukee's LGBTQ community in the 80s and 90s when he was preying on the community.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer rose to infamy after human remains were found dismembered and preserved in his Milwaukee apartment. He murdered at least 16 people in the city. 14 of them were people of color, and many of them had been part of the city's gay community. A Bubbler Talk listener wanted to know how much harm Jeffrey Dahmer's crimes caused Milwaukee's LGBT community. But to understand Dahmer's impact, we first need to look at what life was like for gay Milwaukeeans in the 1980s.
You essentially have a community that grew up being told that they really had no right to exist. You had a community of people who really only knew each other out of a sense of shame, out of a sense of disenfranchisement.
Michael Takash is the curator of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, and he describes an underground community where people used nicknames to obscure their identity. They met at bars in a dark industrial neighborhood surrounded by partially empty factories and warehouses. People were also pretty transient.
You would see somebody and they would be around all the time, and then they would just be gone, and you would really, you know, not think about it or not really question where they had gone.
And in 1987, when Dahmer began preying on people, it was the height of the AIDS epidemic. According to the CDC, more than 500,000 people were living with HIV by 1987 in the United States. Scott Gunkel was a bartender at Club 219, where Dahmer was a regular customer. Although he met Dahmer a few times, Gunkel found him unremarkable. What Gunkel remembers vividly is the impact of AIDS.
One year I went to 19 funerals, and it was just devastating. You know, every other week you'd find somebody that passed away, and then you'd go to their funeral. I would, you know, talk to other people who knew certain people and say, hey, where's so-and-so? And they'd be like, oh, he passed away, or he's sick and he's in a hospice.
In 1991, Dahmer was finally caught after one of his victims managed to escape. As the gruesome reality of his crimes became known, it was truly shocking for the community.
No one had any suspicion at the time. I mean, it wasn't as if there was, you know, this long string of disappearances and people pieced it together. There was no suspicion of anything like this happening while it was happening.
Both Tekash and Gunkel say that for a short time after Dahmer's crimes were revealed, people were nervous about going out.
There was a buildup of paranoia for a while, but it really didn't last. I don't think it lasted more than a couple of months, to be honest.
And in some odd way, Dahmer's crimes led to systemic changes that helped Milwaukee's LGBT community. Although Tekash is careful not to give Dahmer's crime all the credit, the nicknames did go away. People were emboldened to be open about who they were, which made them safer.
Being able to be your true self every day kind of eradicates some of these dangerous situations that people put themselves in just to find acceptance, just to find a community, and just to find a sense of caring and love.
Others like Gunkel were drawn to activism. He started to lead sensitivity training for the Milwaukee Police Department.
Activists got more engaged with the police department. Activists got more engaged with the African-American community. Communities were willing to reach out to each other.
There's no doubt that for some outsiders, Dahmer's gruesome crimes became the defining symbol of Milwaukee's gay community. But for the people who made that community, it was just another part of a long history of abuse. And they weren't about to let these monstrous acts define them.
The resilience of the gay and lesbian community in Milwaukee cannot be overstated. And Jeffrey Dahmer was kind of a fly on the windshield.
Milwaukee's LGBTQ community has come a long way since the 1980s. But that resilience, that's what brought them here. Not Dahmer. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Joy Powers.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
Bubbler Talk is a regular series on WUWM and Lake Effect. You can hear it every Monday on the show, and at wuwm.com, you can hear past episodes, including an exploration of what Milwaukee was like during the Great Depression. Every month here on Lake Effect, we partner with the Milwaukee Public Library for our Book of the Month series to bring you new reading recommendations. MPL librarian Beth Gabriel has a book pick that celebrates the gradual transition into Halloween season and which also honors Hispanic Heritage Month, which ends on October 15th. Beth Gabriel is a librarian reference assistant at the East Branch, and she made an appearance on Lake Effect back in May. She joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to talk about her October book recommendation.
We're rolling into autumn, and it's slowly becoming Halloween season. And for this month's pick, you got an especially horrific recommendation. So what did you pick for this month, Beth?
Yeah, so the book itself is The Hacienda by Isabel Cañas. And I picked it for many reasons. Number one, I was assured that it wouldn't make me too scared. Pretty much a 99% romance reader at this point in my life. But I feel like romance and horror are kind of genre friends. So there's a lot of similarities, like where they have like rules and structure. And I like that a lot. And so this one was recommended to me by some friends who assured me there'd be no children in danger, which is one of my things that I cannot read. And that it didn't have a lot of like body horror, because I don't like that very much either. So this one is more of a psychological, like spiritual horror, more along that lines of like a gothic horror romance. And I also chose it because it is currently Hispanic Heritage Month and the author is Mexican American and she pulls a lot of her culture. It starts at the end of the Mexican Revolution, which is not something I was super familiar with until I picked this up. And now I've looked up a few things about it. And then it has a huge amount of like Catholicism and indigenous religious practices that kind of come together. And you can see the parallels between the two and how after the Inquisition had happened in Mexico, like people are still practicing some of these things that were frowned upon by Catholicism, but also kind of co-opted and taken to use for power. So all of that was really intriguing to me and why I picked it. So you start with your main character, Beatrice, and she is recently married a widower, and he is very handsome and charming, and she's just looking for a way out of her situation. So her father was a general in the revolution, and he was on the wrong side, the losing side. And her mother have been living with her relatives, and they don't like her. She's too brown. She's not beautiful enough, and they treat them terribly. So she takes the first opportunity, this marriage, to get out of her situation. Turns out, well, there's a reason why he's a widower, and it's not a good one. And I don't want to spoil too much, but it's like he's a widower for a reason. The house itself is gorgeous, but has a very dark secret and might be haunted or might be possessed. She's not sure. She starts having visions of like blood and dead bodies and like red eyes watching her in the night. And then people will tell her like, what are you talking about? We don't see what you're seeing. You might be possessed by the devil. So she feels like she's losing her mind. But then like the junior priest, who's very young and very handsome, he tells her he believes her and he'll help her. And it kind of goes from there. And I guess you'll have to read it to find the ending out, but it definitely kept me on my toes.
Throughout the month of October, there's different Halloween type events, different fall events happening through the Milwaukee Public Library. So Beth, what are some Halloween or fall or autumn related things or activities that people can check out?
So if you are a horror fan and like to read and talk about horror books, Bayview Library has a bi-monthly horror book club. So the last session for 2022 is actually on Halloween. So the 31st of October at 6 p.m. at the Bayview branch. My colleague Rachel will be leading a discussion on The Shining by Stephen King, which is a book I actually did read when I was younger. And if you haven't read it, it's just a classic. And it does, if you've seen the movie, only the movie, you will notice like there's quite a difference between some of it, and it's just a really haunting story, and that's another one that has stuck with me through the years. If you're not so much into the spooky Halloween stuff, the Zablocki Library has family crafts every Saturday throughout Hispanic Heritage Month. So that's every Saturday at Zablocki, and they'll be doing sort of Dia de los Muertos and Hispanic Heritage Month fall inspired crafting time. And that's from 9 to 4 p.m. through October 15th. And then I have to recommend our library TikTok account has been blowing up over on TikTok, so I have to plug it. We've got some amazing staff doing really cool videos over there. And if you want a spooky one, I really recommend you check out the Stranger Things inspired TikTok that they created for our central library. It's so good and kind of gets you in that spooky Halloween time feeling too.
Well, Beth, thank you so much for being back on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you too. And hopefully we can do something again soon in the future. And I read my horror book for the season. I think I'm going to go back to my romance books.
Beth Gabriel is a librarian reference assistant at the East Branch of the Milwaukee Public Library. She made an appearance on Lake Effect back in May. Both times, she spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. To listen to past Book of the Month recommendations, you can visit wuwm.com. Coming up, we'll hear some new local music in this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Fall is in the air, the pumpkin spice is brewing, and as always, Milwaukee musicians are putting out some great new music. Every month, Milwaukee Record co-founder Matt Wild compiles a list of some of the best recent releases from local musicians, and he joins us to share a few of those songs. Matt Wild, as always, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, as always, for having me.
So we're looking at a wide variety of songs this month. The first one, I'm always surprised to hear kind of dancey, poppy songs from Milwaukee, but there is definitely a group of artists that continue to release really high quality dance music.
Absolutely. And the song we're going to be talking about right off the top here is by a group called The Quills. And the song is I Can't Sleep. Now, The Quills are a kind of electro dance duo of Sage Schwarm and Becky Heck. Sage is from, folks will remember him from a great old Milwaukee group, Codebreaker. Becky, they're a couple. Becky used to run, along with Sage, the Love Unlimited vintage shop on KK. That, unfortunately, closed down a few years ago after it suffered some damage from a fire. But ever since then, they've been, and even before then, they've been making music as The Quills. And they released a full-length album back in 2017, and they occasionally release some singles, and they've just released this new song, I Can't Sleep. And you're right, it's this great dance kind of track. It's kind of a dark, new wavy, slightly gothy kind of sound, which makes it perfect for this season. And I think, you know, they do a terrific job. I know they covered a Metallica song last year, and now this is kind of their new single for the fall. I think it's perfect for the season. And like I said, kind of a dark, gothy dance vibe. It's The Quills with I Can't Sleep.
I Can't Sleep by The Quills. The next artist that we're going to talk about, I can't remember if we have talked about him before, but I have certainly heard his stuff before. And what I will say is I just love his name. His name is John Henry.
John Henry, yes. And I do believe we talked about him probably about a year ago, because a year ago, John Henry, who's a local singer and rapper, he put out a song called Tour Milwaukee. And it was kind of this crazy song that it almost every line was a reference to a Milwaukee location, a Milwaukee street, a Milwaukee event, Milwaukee people. It was just 100%, 110% Milwaukee. Now, about a year later, he's released a new single. It's called All You Touch and All You See. It's a really great vibe. I really love this song. I would definitely suggest people find the video for this song because like his previous Milwaukee-centric song, this video just practically bleeds Milwaukee. It is just a kind of self-shot video with John Henry kind of hustling around town, going to all these locations, playing, setting up shop in the Deer District, playing shows at Cactus Club, him kind of hauling equipment around. It really shows like his hustle and his like dedication. And it really shows off a lot of great Milwaukee locations. So John Henry with another terrific kind of Milwaukee song. This is All You Touch and All You See.
All you touch and all you see is all your life would ever be. I'm clean, cardigan to my jeans. I drive around the city and feel like I'm king. Style got plenty, chapeaux and magazines. Pretty as new pennies, my passenger black queen. She's smoking hot like a pack of Marlboro. And everything she got, she greedy, she want more of. And every dream I got, you know I'm going hard for it. Beast hard like a gargoyle. You gotta get it to the point you feel you are spoiled. Me and my people treat ourselves like we are royal. She love my aura, even in my old Corolla. She know I'm getting money, acting crazy, call it going donuts. Hold up, you know what? They don't like my clique, well so what? So many haters tried to hoe us, but so far no luck. Ambitious dreams on my master P, I'm so about it. Period, I'm getting commas.
Getting commas.
All you touch and all you see.
All you touch and all you see.
Is all your life will ever be.
Is all your life will ever be.
All You Touch and All You See by John Henry. I will also second. That was a really fun music video. I enjoyed watching that. Now, the next song that we're going to look at, all of these songs, I should say, are very different. This is a sharp left turn. This is a, I think, just an artist, right? Paper Holland is an artist.
Paper Holland is a duo right now. It formerly was a full band. I think they're just down to two members now, and they're kind of in the midst of some change. Paper Holland, about 4 years ago, put out a terrific record called Galapagos, and it was this real kind of sunny, kind of island, tropical pop of a record. And now, 4 years later, they're kind of reconfiguring, and they've released a new single. It's called What to Wear, and it is from an upcoming album called Devolver. And it's a big left turn for them. It is very much inspired kind of by 60s British Invasion, certainly the Beatles, and bands like that. This is another one, too, where I would suggest people search out the video, because that, too, is very, very much inspired by kind of early proto-60s British music videos, before music videos were, like, really music videos. Definitely has kind of, you know, Hard Day's Night or Help kind of vibes. And I don't know, it's a really interesting direction for Paper Holland. And it's a really catchy song that just kind of gets in your head. It's kind of a cheeky, I don't know if you want to call it an ode to climate change, but it's kind of a cheeky song about climate change and not knowing what to wear these days. So this is the latest from Paper Holland. It's called What to Wear.
Anymore. Sun
What to Wear by Paper Holland. Now, the final song we're going to talk about, it's from a group I know we've spoken about before, Foxface, and this is a song that is really in response to what's been happening in the news.
Absolutely. Foxface is a terrific band that's been around for, had been around for 10 years. They sadly played their final show at the recent Bayview Bash. They've hung it up after about a decade together. And I know we've talked about them on the show before, just a great kind of femme-led punk band, very kind of angry feminist lyrics and songs. And that's certainly this song, too. What we'll be listening to is a live version of the first track off their 2021 album. The album was called End of Man, and the song is called Vessels. And this live version is contained on a new compilation that was just released. It is a reproductive rights benefit compilation of a bunch of Milwaukee and Chicago artists. It is called O SCOTUS, Up Yours, in response, of course, to the recent SCOTUS reversal of Roe v. Wade. And like I said, Foxface, a terrific band for so long. They played their final show. It really makes sense that kind of their final release would be on a compilation like this. This is, you know, right in their wheelhouse. I mean, just to give you an idea of some of the lyrics here for Vessels, please keep your hands up off my body and your mouth shut if you're not yourself. It's so strange how you have so many ideas when it's somebody else. Very to the point and just terrific as always. This was Foxface, such a great band, and it's sad to see them hang it up, but what a way to go out on. This is a live version of Vessels from the late, great Foxface.
Vessels by Foxface. Matt Wild, as always, thank you so much for sharing these songs with us.
Thank you for having me. Always love sharing these.
Yeah. Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup and shares a few of those songs with us. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com. It's a really great resource if you're just getting into Milwaukee music. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about a program at Children's Wisconsin supporting youth survivors of violence. Plus, we'll look at a pilot program at Marquette, which will have administrators and students living side by side in residence halls. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.